breaking news in Madison and beyond, just subscribe to WORT Local News Podcast. Our volunteer reporters are on standby to investigate the latest news in our community. That includes protests. Local politics.
I believe that this subpoena is a mockery.
Well, my initial reaction is always like, what truth are they talking about?
Arts and culture.
There just aren't very many Oak Savannahs left, but they're a very unique, beautiful landscape to walk through.
I guess you can tell quite a bit about a watch by winding it and setting it.
And everything in between. New episodes are available every Monday through Thursday at 7:30 p.m. Subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, from Apple Podcasts to Spotify. Just search for the WORT Local News. Bringing you local news and information since 1975, this is WORT Madison.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, March 10th, Pledge Drive edition of Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. Today is your last opportunity this drive to let us know that you support Worldview and its commitment to bring you world news and to be the community in community radio. We volunteer here at WORT to research stories not easily available and bring them to you, along with connections to the world with our featured guests from far and near. 2 weeks ago, we talked to guests from Madison's Return Peace Corps volunteer group and Open Doors for Refugees. And then last week, Gil and Amit talked to Harsh Mander, a very prestigious interview with a great guy, and he was in India. So you too can contribute your part, which are donations for things that we can't volunteer for and that cost money, things like the roof and the windows and the technical equipment. So please, take a minute now to contribute what you can, as much as you can, whether it's $5 or $500, for Worldview or just for WORT in general, before the fundraising drive is over tonight, by calling. Go ahead.
608-256-2001. Call us at 608-256-2001 or go online at wortfm.org and click the donate button. We really need to hear from you. We would love to hear from you. We know that this program is valuable to a lot of you and that the station itself is as well. So let's put your money where your ears are right now. And
put this fundraiser to bed tonight in good shape. And then later in the program, after the news, we have something special for you once again. Longtime Worldview Collective member Norman Stockwell, who's now the publisher of the Progressive magazine, will talk to independent journalist Jeff Abbott as the two take a quick tour around Latin America. But first, we have the news.
Senegal's Constitutional Council ruled on Wednesday that presidential elections must be held before President Macky Sall's mandate expires on April 2nd and set the election date as March 24th. The early date means that the usual campaigns will be shortened for the 19 candidates now vying for the presidential seat. The campaigns will also be held during the month of Ramadan, when many in the Muslim-majority country fast. With a record number of candidates in the race, the chances are high none of them will win more than 50% of the vote and avoid a second round head-to-head. President Macky Sall also dissolved the government on Wednesday, replacing Prime Minister Amadou Ba with Interior Minister Sidiki Kaba to help Ba, the ruling coalition's presidential candidate, focus on his electoral campaign. Tensions had gripped the country since early February when President Macky Sall postponed the February 25th elections to December, citing disputes over candidates and alleged corruption in the Constitutional Council's approval of some of those candidates. Sall was accused of attempting to stay in power, which he denied. Relieved of the uncertainty, Senegalese presidential candidates launched their shortened campaigns yesterday in a competition with no favorites. Presidential race remains wide open.
Senior Sudanese Armed Forces General Yasser Alatta said today there would be no truce in Sudan in the Islamic holy month of Ramadan unless the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF paramilitary group, leaves the homes and sites of civilians. The United Nations Security Council had called for a truce during Ramadan, which begins this week, and the RSF said it welcomed the ceasefire call. But General Atta's statement said that the RSF must comply with a commitment made last May to withdraw from civilian homes and public facilities. The UN says that nearly 25 million people, half Sudan's population, need aid, that some 8 million have fled their homes, and that hunger and probable famine is rising. The U.S. has accused both of the warring parties of committing war crimes. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has also urged a Ramadan truce. Sudan's UN ambassador told the UN Security Council on Thursday that the head of the army and ruling council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, had commended Guterres's appeal, but was wondering how it could be implemented.
Pakistan People's Party co-chairperson Asif Ali Zardari has won a second term as Pakistan's president, supported by the ruling coalition in a vote by parliament and regional assemblies. The Election Commission of Pakistan announced yesterday, after tallying the votes by national MPs, provincial MPs, and senators, that Zardari received 411 votes. His opponent, Mehmood Khan Achkazi, backed by the party of imprisoned former Prime Minister Imran Khan, received 181 votes. Zardari is the widower of Pakistan's assassinated first female leader, Benazir Bhutto. He was voted into the largely ceremonial post by the PPP, which formed an alliance with the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, or PMLN, party, after Pakistan's February 8th elections that were marred with rigging claims. He was expected to be sworn in at a ceremony today. Under the terms of the coalition pact, which also includes a number of smaller parties, the PMLN's Shahbaz Sharif was sworn in as prime minister last Monday.
On Friday, March 8th, International Women's Day, small groups of Afghan women gathered in private spaces to demand that harsh restrictions on their freedoms be lifted, despite recent Taliban crackdowns on protests that have seen activists detained. In northern Takhar province, seven women held papers obscuring their faces, reading "Rights, Justice, Freedom." In Balkh province, several women also held up signs saying, "Don't give the Taliban a chance," in front of a banner reading, "Save Afghanistan Women." About 20 women gathered at an event organized by the Afghanistan Association of the Blind in northern Mazar-e-Sharif city on Thursday. One attendee said, quote, "It's very painful that a woman has no value in our society today. She cannot use any of her rights," unquote. Marking International Women's Day, the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan urged the Taliban government to lift restrictions on women and girls, saying not doing so risked, quote, "further pushing the country into deeper poverty and isolation," unquote. Taliban authorities have repeatedly dismissed international criticism as propaganda. On Friday, on Tolo TV, Taliban spokesperson Zabihullah Mujahid said that Taliban government was committed to women's rights within the framework of Islam. And I think it might be a great idea because we have Mike sitting outside. Michael is usually here for our show.
Thank you, Michael, for being there to handle the phones.
And we really appreciate him, and he shows up. So we want to ask you to be like Michael and show up for us and show up for WORT and call
608-256-2001, 608-256-2001, or go online at wortfm.org, click the donate button. You'll get all the information you need there about how to make your pledge of support, how to fill it out and donate the money that you feel you want to send to us. It's really easy. Michael can guide you through it as well if you give him a call at 608-256-2001. Perhaps you're already a contributor and just haven't and need to increase it, or you just haven't pledged for this year. This would be a great time to do it if you're a Worldview listener and tune in for this kind of news that you don't really get anywhere else on the radio anyway. So if that's important to you, call us at 608-256-2001 and consider whether you are already a regular contributor, perhaps an annual one, or a new contributor, consider becoming an Evergreen member by pledging anywhere from $5 to $500 a month. I'm not expecting anyone to pledge $500 a month, but let's say from $5 to $30 a month, that would come out of your checkbook. It's really easy to do, and I'm sure that you probably do it with other expenses, bills that you get that can be automatically withdrawn. It's a very easy process. Michael can lead you through it, and we have information on the webpage if you go to wortfm.org that will tell you how to do that. So please consider that seriously. We have lots of needs at the station in terms of keeping the lights on and keeping the message of Worldview and the music and everything else we have here going out over the airwaves, so you can get it, or streaming out over the internet where you may be listening to us as well.
Or on your phone.
Yeah, or on your phone.
Phone app. So, hey, call us at 608-256-2001 or go online to wortfm.org.
And we will continue now with news from Latin America. Protesters in Mexico smashed through the doors of the presidential palace Wednesday morning. A video from a local TV station shows protesters breaking down the door using a white pickup truck from Mexico's state electrical company, while President Andrés Manuel López Obrador was giving his daily morning press conference inside. The group was protesting the disappearance of 43 students in 2014. A report in 2023 revealed that Mexican security forces were complicit in the abduction and killing of the students, one of Mexico's worst human rights atrocities. The government had alleged that the students had been kidnapped by corrupt police involved with local drug gangs. However, an investigation by the Interdisciplinary Group of Independent Experts said in their findings that the Army, Navy, police, and intelligence agencies knew minute by minute where the students were. Obrador, who was a critic of the previous government, created a truth commission to look into the case, but the students' bodies have never been found.
Electoral authorities in Venezuela announced last week that presidential elections are scheduled for July 28th. Currently, incumbent Nicolas Maduro holds all the cards with his ruling party, the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, which named him as its candidate. The election date was announced as Venezuela's country's top court decided to ban popular opposition candidate Maria Corina Machado from running for office. The announcement reflected the government's intention to move on from a heated debate over its earlier decision to bar Machado from public office. Machado is the first real political threat Maduro has faced in years, and she won the independently run presidential primary with more than 90% of the votes. Despite the ban, Machado continues campaigning and has rejected the idea of providing a substitute. Her campaign has yet to comment on the announcement of the election day. Candidates must register by March 25th, giving Machado and other opposition factions less than 3 weeks to decide on their next steps.
And we'll take another break here. That's a wrap of the headlines from Latin America. And coming up, we'll be heading into some headlines from the Middle East. But we'd really like to hear from you. This is the way the program works, during Fund Drive anyway, is that we take these breaks. But the way the program works is that we bring you headlines from four different regions of the world and some longer stories from each of those regions, and then we bring you a feature, and we think that it's really well-researched news that you're not going to find anywhere else, and hope that we have those of you out there who are tuning in regularly for this. And we would be really glad to thank you for calling us right now at 608-256-2001. We can thank you by name on the air, or you can donate anonymously. But you would be helping to support a program that is really important to the community and hopefully to you as well. And speaking of thank yous, I've just gotten a note that we would like to thank Soups. I did it again. That's the organization, the food service organization that provided soups for us here at WRT. We're really fortunate that we get to hear from businesses around the city during Fund Drive, who their contribution to getting us to raising money for the station is
another sign that this is a great community.
Right. They provide food for us so that we can reach out to you and you can reach back to us with your contribution.
And so Soups, I did it again, brought us some soup. All right.
I've had it. It's delicious.
All right.
And so we're waiting for the phones to ring. Michael is out there. Give us a call at 608-256-2001 or go online at WRTFM.org. And the news from the Middle East now. The foreign ministries of France and Spain on Friday condemned the Israeli government's intention to expand its settlements in the occupied West Bank and to construct 3,500 new housing units in those settlements and demanded that Israel reverse its decision. The French Ministry of Foreign Affairs said in a statement, quote, "Israeli settlement of Palestinian lands is a flagrant violation of international law and must stop," unquote. It called for the dismantling of settlement outposts without delay. The Spanish Ministry of Foreign Affairs said, quote, "The settlements violate international law, undermine efforts to reach a two-state solution, and constitute an obstacle to peace," unquote. The United Nations Human Rights Commissioner, Volker Türk, warned on Friday that the establishment and expansion of Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories constitutes a war crime and could eliminate any practical possibility of establishing a viable Palestinian state. More than 490,000 Israelis currently live in settlements in the West Bank that are considered illegal under international law.
The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported today that 730 academics in Israel have supported a signature campaign launched to call on their country's conservative government to take urgent measures to help starving Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, quote, "before it causes mass deaths due to the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza getting out of control," unquote. The academics also stressed the need to release Israeli hostages detained in Gaza. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA, reported today that, quote, "hunger is everywhere in the Gaza Strip." They said, quote, "the situation in northern Gaza is tragic as ground aid is prevented despite repeated appeals," unquote. As a result of the war and Israeli restrictions, the residents of Gaza, especially in the north, are on the verge of famine as the Israeli occupation army controls food, water, medicine, and fuel supplies. Some 2 million Palestinians have been locked in the Gaza Strip, which has been besieged by Israel for 17 years. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, at least 25 Palestinian citizens, mostly women and children, have starved to death in Gaza as of today. And those are headlines. Now, here's Gil with our first longer story.
In Nigeria's northwest, more than 280 children aged between 7 and 18 were taken from a school in Kuriga on Thursday. Yesterday, 15 more children were taken in another raid on a school in Sokoto. Nigerian security forces are searching the forest and setting up roadblocks in the attempt to find them, but observers said combing the woodlands could take weeks. These abductions were the latest group of kidnappings by gunmen who target schools, colleges, and highways, looking for large groups of victims whose families will pay ransoms. No group has yet claimed responsibility for these kidnappings. Kuriga is a quiet village about 60 miles outside the city of Kaduna. As the school's 1,000 students settled into classes on Thursday morning, dozens of armed men in military uniforms rode into the school grounds. A student who escaped the kidnappers said that the students were herded into the surrounding forest and beaten by the kidnappers as they walked for hours. He said the boys and girls were separated and that there were more girls than boys. Kaduna State Governor Uba Sani visited Kuriga and promised to get the students released. Parents were beside themselves with grief, with no idea of what they should do. They blamed the kidnapping on a lack of security in the area and neglect by the central government. Amnesty International called on Nigerian authorities to safely rescue the students and hold the perpetrators to account. It posted on X, quote, "Schools should be places of safety and no child should have to choose between their education and their life," unquote. Abductions of students from schools in northern Nigeria have been a source of concern since 2014, when Islamic extremists kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls in Borno State's Chibok village. More recently, the abductions have been concentrated in northwestern and central regions, where dozens of armed groups often target villagers and travelers for huge ransoms.
The Bagmati River runs through Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, and the revered Pushpatinath Temple. But in recent decades, the river has transformed into a sewer canal, as untreated raw sewage has been discharged into its waters. In order to rejuvenate the sacred river, officials are drafting plans to build a 300-foot-tall dam to collect rainwater during the rainy season and release it in the dry. But some question the viability and safety of the dam due to fragile geologic conditions revealed by recent earthquakes in Nepal, as well as climate change. Building a dam might jeopardize millions of lives and threaten the inundation of the temple, one of Hinduism's holiest shrines and a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Unlike most rivers in Nepal, rain and spring water are the main sources of water for the Bagmati. The others are permanently snowmelt fed, or perennially snowmelt fed. Unplanned urbanization and paving over large areas, as well as the construction of roads along the riverbank, are causing the natural springs to dry up. Since rainwater runoff can't filter into the soil and recharge the aquifers, springs release less water into the river during the dry season. But the river swells during the monsoon, when Nepal receives 60% to 90% of its annual rainfall in 4 months, then diminishes to a trickle during the dry season, when the only water flowing into the river comes from untreated sewage. Sharwan Kumar Sharma, a Rights of Nature campaigner, said there are 4 main risks associated with building a dam. The first, that the dam may never be full to its capacity due to climate change. The second, that thousands of trees would need to be removed. Third, according to Nepali law, 10 trees must be planted for every one tree removed, and there's just not enough room for that. And fourth, cement and its dust from the construction will all end up in Kathmandu. According to the draft environmental impact assessment, there are problems of pollution of many sorts that will be associated with the construction of the dam. And when operational, it risks failure due to earthquakes, threatening people and religious sites. Most experts consulted about the project indicated that the unproven solutions the dam might bring and the under-considered problems dam construction and existence might have definitely require further study and consideration of how to treat current problems like the Bagmati River pollution and unregulated urbanization.
In Haiti, a 72-hour state of emergency was declared last Sunday night following an explosion of violence during the weekend. That violence included gunmen from gangs overrunning the country's two largest prisons and freeing their inmates. On Thursday, the state of emergency was extended until April 3rd. Some media outlets criticized the government's failure to enforce the first state of emergency. A nighttime curfew was also put in place until this morning at 5 a.m. Meanwhile, the gangs continued to demonstrate their power by seizing control of police stations and setting them on fire. The surge of violence began after Prime Minister Ariel Henry traveled to Kenya to sign an agreement that would help bring in a United Nations-backed security force from Kenya to help stabilize Haiti in its conflict with the increasingly powerful armed groups. He has not returned to Haiti due to the seizure of the airport and ongoing violence. The gangs have reportedly united to bring down the de facto prime minister. Jimmy Terrizier, known as Barbecue and Haiti's most powerful gang leader, has said, quote, "If Ariel Henry doesn't step down, the country will suffer genocide. If he doesn't step down, if the international community continues to support him, they will lead us directly into a civil war that will end in a genocide." The United States shared in a press conference that they are not pushing the prime minister to resign, but are rather urging Henry to, quote, expedite the transition to an empowered and inclusive governance structure that will move with urgency to help the country prepare for a multinational security support mission, unquote. Henry was sworn in as prime minister in July of 2021, 2 weeks after the assassination of President Jovenel Moise, who had chosen Henry for the post shortly before he was killed. Despite Henry not being formally installed as prime minister, he was chosen by a core group, which included representatives from the UN, Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, Spain, the EU, the US, and the Organization of American States. Haiti's Rive National Party, political party, has proposed a presidential council with former Senator Guy Philippe as the proposed president of Haiti. Philippe was recently deported to Haiti from the U.S., having spent 6 years in prison for money laundering derived from drug trafficking. He also led the coup that ousted elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004.
The heads of the Libyan parliament, state, and presidential councils agreed today to form a unified government and a technical committee to consider introducing amendments to electoral laws. This agreement was reached during a meeting in Cairo under the auspices of the League of Arab States. A second round of the meeting was agreed upon to complete the agreement and bring it into force. The attendees are calling on the United Nations support mission in Libya and the international community to support this consensus in order to ensure the success of the election process. In June last year, a 6+6 committee formed by the House of Representatives and the High Council of State issued draft laws according to which the expected elections would be held. But most of its provisions were opposed by some sitting political parties. Libyans hope to hold elections to end conflicts and divisions that intensified in early 2022 due to disagreement between their two governments, one headed by Osama Hamad and appointed by the House of Representatives in the East, and the other in the west of the country, recognized by the United Nations and headquartered in the capital, Tripoli, which is the national unity government headed by Abdelhamid Aldebaba. Aldebaba has not yet commented on what was agreed upon in Cairo, but he has in the past emphasized that he will only hand over power to a government that comes through an elected parliament. Aldebaba and his military and the political parties supporting him refused to form a new government, accusing the parties supporting this idea of seeking to remain in power and extending the transitional periods. But it's difficult to predict the extent of his ability to resist the increasing demands calling for him to step down for a change of government. The U.S. has shown openness to forming a new government in Libya. The U.S. Special Envoy to Libya, Ambassador Richard Norland, stressed during his meeting with Dabeiba last week the importance of forming a caretaker government with the participation of all Libyan factions in the political process sponsored by the United Nations mission. And that's a wrap of news from around the world for Sunday, March 10th, 2024. I'm Lee Rowe.
And I'm Gil Halstead.
And the sources we used to prepare today's stories were the Agence France-Presse, Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, All Africa, Anadolu, the AP News, the BBC, Democracy Now!, France 24, Haaretz, the Haitian Times, Mongabay, National Public Radio, Kutz, and Reuters. And Gil, tell us, do you contribute to WORT?
I do. I'm an evergreen supporter of WRT. I have a certain amount of money taken out of my bank account on a monthly basis. That I've been doing that for 4 or 5 years because I listen to the station and I volunteer physically, but I feel like I need to actually contribute financially as well. And so I have found a way to fit that into my budget, and I'm hoping that others who have the same positive feelings about WRT will consider doing the same. $5 a month, $10 a month, $15 a month. It's a great way to support the station, and it helps the station have a certain amount of guarantee about how much money is coming in
right.
each month.
But also, if you just want to try it for a time or two,
right.
go ahead. Please call us at 608-256-2001. Or go online to WORTFM.org and click on that contact button. And now we have to move along and get to our wonderful feature for today, featuring Norm Stockwell and Jeff Abbott, who is an independent reporter.
We're here at Worldview speaking via the internet with Jeff Abbott, independent journalist based in Guatemala, and also reminding you that this is a pledge drive edition of Worldview. So please go to your phone, 608-256-2001, extension 1, or you can go online to WORTFM.org and pledge your support to keep this kind of international news on the air here at your local community radio station. Jeff Abbott, welcome to WORT. You've been working as a journalist now in Latin America for more than a decade, and reporting regularly for the Progressive Magazine, for Al Jazeera, for many other publications. How's it going?
Really, like, Latin America is in a state of transition. Across the hemisphere, we're seeing the pendulum swing between very interesting extremes. You know, you can have a government in El Salvador like that of Nayib Bukele, who has really fallen on the far right, and then having a progressive government in Guatemala, two countries that have been are right next to each other and have really been at the forefront of the whole authoritarian question for a long time.
Okay. Well, let's start. Let's go through some of those different countries and some of the things that are going on. And we'll start with the most recent news, which actually just happened yesterday. And that is former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez was convicted in a U.S. federal court of drug trafficking, participating in a drug trafficking operation that included payments to drug lords like El Chapo and others. And the story of Juan Orlando Hernandez is he was the president of Honduras for two terms following there was a coup in 2009. We've reported on that extensively here on WORT, and then the presidency of Pepe Lobo, which was followed by Juan Orlando being elected in 2013, an election that I covered at the time, and then again reelected in spite of the fact that that was not previously legal under the
illegality of it.
Right. So talk a little bit about what this means. What does it mean for a former Honduran president to be convicted in a U.S. federal court?
Well, this really shows like a couple things. One, the fact that the Honduran courts are not considered capable. This is a massive, like, showing of the fact that international community does not see Honduras as being capable of processing a precedent. So this, in many regards, it sheds a light on the crisis of impunity in Honduras. And they've been going through the process of trying to get an international-backed commission to combat impunity. I'm still not sure exactly how to say it. CICIT. But basically the International Convention Against Impunity in Honduras, which is built off of the Guatemalan example, the CICIG. But I mean, first off, that's the major thing this shows. The second thing is the fact that this is an embedded political situation in Honduras. The coup opened up the door for these structures to basically build their networks, their influence in the region. And really this whole case is an example of that. It's, as one analyst told me, it really is a example of the image, the effect of the image that has it been impacted by Honduras.
So, you know, we talked about the issue of a Honduran president running for a second term, and that actually happened also in the neighboring country of El Salvador just recently. Talk about
and Nicaragua.
Yes, yes, well, true. But let's talk first about El Salvador, where Nayib Bukele was just reelected in spite of a constitutional prohibition on that.
Yeah, so Nayib Bukele was reelected on February 4th, I believe. And there are concerns about the other aspects of the reelection, especially related to Congress. There were fraud accusations, as there always are. But the reelection of Bukele is really a showing of the fact that his anti-crime, anti-gang policy has a social psychological impact in the country that has been so impacted by gang violence over the years. Like the MS-13, Barrio 18 have impacted that society so much that people in that country are willing to give up with constitutional rights in order to have a sense of security. And that led him to win an illegal re-election. He has taken it very well, hitting it, what you know, a illegal re-election. He's ridden it into the, you know, being viewed as an example for not just Latin America but the United States. He spoke at the Conservative Political Action Committee meeting in February, where he was met like a rock star, and he he's painting this wave of support across the region. Governments across the hemisphere are copying his methods. The government of Argentina just recently published images of gang member criminal individuals, you know, in their underwear, just like El Salvador has. Ecuador has done the same. So he's become this kind of perverted example for the region. And at the same time, we have to recognize that he's been also utilizing a far-right narrative that taps into the same conspiracies we hear in the United States, the same subtle anti-Semitic dog whistles around George Soros. He made a whole statement about, like, during the CPAC speech about, you know, the media and, like, this international conspiracy around the media that really just echoes this anti-Semitic narrative we're seeing rise everywhere on the right these days.
You know, certainly another speaker at CPAC was Viktor Orban, again, echoing many of those same things. But let's talk about this rise of authoritarianism in Latin America, because we're seeing it in both Central and South America. And most recently in Argentina, the election of Javier Milei as president, very much a right-wing libertarian who espouses some of the same views as Donald Trump. And also just a week ago, I think about a week ago, there was a rally in Brazil supporting the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, which included people wearing hats that read, "Make Brazil Great Again." 100,000 people, I think, in this rally, so not insignificant.
I mean, we have to recognize that the far right has a long history in Latin America. Like, fascism had a seat here and still has a seat here. Mexico has a long history of fascism that rose in the 1920s. Guatemala at one point was considered one of the most open market for anti-Semitic literature in the 1960s, according to one academic I've spoken with over the years. And so this authoritarian shift just builds off of a history that it has existed for a very long time here. The far right has a base, and in many regards, this base was supported by the United States. You know, during the 1960s, 70s, the anti-communist movement built off of these bases, supported these bases, fed them that they'd get into this bigger and bigger monstrosity. And that's, I think that, like, this pendulum we're seeing in the region is based off of the fact that none of the governments can resolve political crises with, you know, in the sense that it makes everyone happy, right? So you're going to see Mexico's going to have an election. You know, there are already anti-Semitic narratives within that election. You're going to see this whole thing keep playing out. And when one government doesn't do well, the other side's going to win out the next election. I mean, Boric in Chile has been facing a lot of criticism. What does that mean for the next Chilean election? The right's probably going to do well. So, like, Bolsonaro is, you know, trying to show his support by this, like, this massive rally. But what happens if Lula does really well in his term? Well, I mean, Bolsonaro can't participate until 2030 again. That's, you know, one thing. that's just him trying to show his hand, right? That he's still got influence.
Certainly these far right movements are getting support internationally from other far right efforts, including Steve Bannon.
Mm-hmm.
And his organization that's supporting this kind of far right agenda in so many different countries around the globe right now. Another interesting case is Ecuador, where again the issue of gangs and crime really influenced the politics of the nation recently.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, Ecuador went to the polls last year, and, like, in the lead up to the elections, you know, a presidential candidate who was promoting, like, heavy handed tactics against gang violence against organized crime was assassinated.
In a TV station.
Well, he was leaving a TV station. He was getting in the car when he was assassinated.
Yeah.
But that whole situation influenced how that election played out. Ecuador elected Daniel Noboa to the presidency. The guy is young. I mean, he's in his late 20s. He won, you know, with a major amount of the vote. And he has utilized this crisis of violence caused by organized crime to militarize the country. I mean, they just reinstated the state of emergency for another 30 days, I think yesterday or the day before. So he's another one of these examples that has utilized this whole crime narrative to build this not anti-democratic, because he has to fight for re-election. Like, Ecuador is going to have another election in a year or so, and he has to show why he needs to get reelected. And he's utilizing this whole tough on crime policy as the means to do so. And why is Ecuador? Like, Ecuador went from one of the safest countries in Latin America to one of the most dangerous countries in Latin America really quickly. I mean, we're talking within 5 to 10 years. And one of the analysis that I've heard is that it's related to the fact that it dollarized their economy. So it became a hub of money laundering for international crime groups. So in many regards, I think this whole tough on crime policy basically results in this authoritarian model where it just becomes a means to maintain the status quo and make things worse for everybody else.
We're speaking with Jeff Abbott, independent journalist based in Guatemala, and you're listening to Worldview here on WRT, and this is a pledge drive edition of Worldview. 608-256-2001 is the number to call, extension 1 to speak to a pledge taker, and also online, WORTFM.org. You can get lots of different special thank you gifts, including a one-year subscription to the Progressive Magazine, which features a lot of work by our guest, Jeff Abbott, and talks about a lot of these issues in much greater depth than we're able to do in this short period of time. There's also various sweatshirts and carrying bags and so on. But really, the thank you that we offer you here at WRT is this programming 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, produced by volunteers for the community. This particular program, Worldview, is one of the longest running news and public affairs programs on WRT, started in the late 1970s. And pretty much in this same time slot, this Sunday evening time slot, every single week in and week out, year in and year out, bringing you this kind of news that you're not going to get anywhere else. First-hand interviews with people in these regions around the globe, bringing you insights into what's going on. 608-256-2001, extension 1, or WORTFM.org. Please pledge your support right now. So, Jeff, we've talked a little bit about some of these different authoritarian governments. We haven't touched on Nicaragua yet, but we should. There was, of course, another presidential election not too long ago in Nicaragua where Daniel Ortega was reelected. He's been president now since 2006. And, of course, previously he served a couple of terms from 1979 through 1990. Okay. And in Nicaragua, the case was that a lot of the opposition candidates were actually jailed leading up to the election, basically leaving the field open to Daniel to win the presidency after many years of forming pacts with some of the right-wing organizations and the more established church groups in the country. Since then, he has outlawed a number of non-governmental organizations and some religious organizations, which is a pattern also that we've seen in El Salvador.
Yeah, I mean, in many regards, I would argue that Nicaragua set the playbook for authoritarian regimes in the region. Nicaragua, Ortega and his wife have been trying to build what one person I interviewed basically referred to as like a kingdom, like in the feudal sense, that they are the ones trying to maintain power. I mean, this is a complete betrayal of the Sandinista revolution that we saw in the 70s. He has in and of himself become a dictator. But in many regards, like what he has carried out is the exact same model that other governments have tried to carry out in the pursuit of power. First off, Juan Orlando Hernandez follows his example of seeking re-election. Second, in El Salvador, you could see within the Bukele administration the concentration of power. You could see the same in Guatemala, but Guatemala is kind of its own case because none of those efforts worked. With Nicaragua, like everything Ortega has been doing has been just trying to consolidate his power, stripping people of their property, like his opposition of the property, of their housing, of their whatever, exiling people, barring the Jesuit order from the country, attacking the university. This is part of the crisis we've seen in the region, especially given the massive levels of Nicaraguan migration, which historically, you know, went towards Costa Rica, but now are headed north.
Let's switch a little bit of our focus here now to the environment. Okay. And in the last months, certainly over the last several years, but particularly in the last several months, Latin America, particularly South America, has been plagued by huge wildfires, clearly connected to climate change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. Due to the causes of El Nino, the climate effect, which sees higher temperatures like impact the region, we have been seeing massive, extensive wildfires break out across the whole hemisphere, not just South America. We're seeing the same in Guatemala, in Honduras. It dries out the environment. And in South America, in Chile, for example, there were heavy rains last year, resulting in higher growth of vegetation. Then the higher temperatures come, dry it all out, and any spark, explode the situation. And this has really caused in a crisis across the whole region, from, I'd say, from Guatemala down to Patagonia. Colombia has seen historic wildfires break out and has had to require international help to combat them. Guatemala, too, in February had massive wildfires break out on the volcano known as Agua, just outside of Guatemala City, just above the Antigua, the tourist destination Antigua, that encircled the entire volcano. So climate change is really impacting the region in these extremes, where heavy rain results in, massive growth of vegetation, and then high temperatures results in these fires. I mean, we've already been seeing that 2024 is going to have the highest temperatures on record historically. So climate change is really brutalizing the region. Around end of February, there were around 20-25 fires that broke out across the country. And many of the communities where these wildfires broke out, had no firefighting team. In Quetzaltenango, the department of Quetzaltenango, there was a number of indigenous communities that saw these fires break out. And before even the government responded, migrant community in the United States responded, sending back money so they could, contract helicopters give food to community members who had gone out on these brigades to combat the fire. And about a week afterwards, the Guatemalan government went and did a press conference in one of these communities that was affected. And one of the communities affected by the wildfires spoke out, they didn't let him speak. And they haven't recognized fully how the remittances assisted in combating these wildfires. And really, we have to recognize, the Guatemalan government is weakened by decades of, austerity measures, where they're not able to respond rapidly because, corruption, because the state's been rolled back. But the community of the United States, came through and sent money back to make sure that the community could fight the fire back. Granted, they didn't do much because it spread to the next community over, but it's still an example of, you got to have a organized state response to be able to combat the fires. Because as one of the people I spoke to for my piece for The Progressive mentioned, if you don't stop a fire within the first hour, it's going to be a struggle to break back.
We only have a couple minutes left, and I want to just finish up by talking about the first couple of months of the new presidency there in Guatemala, because it really was a moment in which democracy triumphed. People organized to protect the election of President Arevalo in the sense you described it to me once as kind of like a reverse January 6th. Where the people stood up to protect democracy rather than allow an election to be invalidated. So tell us that story in the last couple minutes that we have.
June 25th in Guatemala saw a massive surprise when Arevalo won. He didn't win. He came in second in the general elections. He was an outsider candidate who had been polling in eighth place, I believe. And on election day, he came through in second. He went on, after many attempts to derail his candidacy, his party. The right wing and the anti-democratic movement in Guatemala threw everything at the wall, including the kitchen sink, against him. But he went on to win the runoff on August 20th. And they kept throwing everything at him. He finally took office on, January 15th. At 1 a.m. Since he took office, he has really shown his dedication to combating corruption. That's been one of his primary acts as government. Through his Ministry of the Interior, he has been really combating extortions in the country, including the dissolving of a police division over accusations of corruption and accusations of extorting migrants. In general, that's where his focus has been. And he's got a massive challenge trying to recuperate the state. Guatemala, in general, is just in a crisis. It's a prolonged crisis. The hospital system has announced that they're without, funds for the rest of the year because they've already used up everything in the first 2 months of the year. So he's fighting an uphill battle, and there's still the legal challenges against his party. But I would say that there are already good examples of how his administration is operating. It's still early to make any critique of them, but it's a reformist administration, where they're apologizing for things that in the past no one has apologized for. And they're trying to recuperate this whole concept of the state when everything has kind of fallen behind in the wayside in the previous administrations. So in the short term, there's been struggles, but we'll see where it goes.
Okay, well, Jeff Abbott, thank you so much for joining us today on Worldview. Jeff Abbott, independent journalist at in Guatemala and reporting at The Progressive magazine and elsewhere. Thank you, Jeff, so much for joining us. Again, 608-256-2001 is the number to call if you would like to support Worldview here on WORT. This program can only happen because of you, so please go to your phones right now.
And thank you, Norm and Jeff Abbott, for bringing us up to date on Latin America. And we want you to call right now. WORT needs you. This is the last day of this fundraiser. So 608-256-2001 or WORTFM.org. And now stay tuned for Salamat.
WORT 89.9 FM Madison has been streaming since the turn of the century, but the best way to tune in is on the WORT app. The WORT app allows you to listen to our live stream or archived shows anywhere you can use your phone. It features sections covering the latest news, music happenings, and talk stories, as well as a listing of our podcasts and a current playlist. And you can access and track through our archives seamlessly. You can connect to our social media pages or send us a message through the app or fall asleep listening to WORT with our handy sleep clock. Download the app from Play Store for your Android or from the App Store for your Apple devices. Interact and listen to your favorite community radio station with the WORT app, all from the comforts of phone.
In Arabic, we are known to say Ibrak ayyamak bitanfidh kalamak.
Translation: bless your days when you live up to your words.